Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Mark Olson. I'm here representing the appellant, Nicole Sanders, in this matter. First of all, it should be noted that the trial court awarded permanent maintenance to my client, and that issue is not in dispute on appeal. Therefore, the permanent maintenance award is intact. The issues raised on appeal are whether actually deal with the amount of the maintenance award and also the trial court's decision not to award any attorney's fees. The standard of review in this matter is abuse of discretion on both of those particular issues, the amount of maintenance awarded, as well as the decision whether or not to award the attorney's fees. I would begin by indicating that it's our position that the trial court failed to balance the economic positions of the parties in any sort of a reasonable and fair manner in this case. We would submit there's only one real logical explanation for what occurred here, and that is the trial court split the proverbial baby in half. My client was seeking $1,000 in maintenance in a 22-year marriage where she was a traditional homemaker, as determined by the trial court. On the other hand, the respondent was offering nothing. This court may ask why my client was only seeking $1,000 under the circumstances, where it likely would have been more appropriate to try to seek some sort of a balancing of the income and resources of the parties. From the very beginning, my client wanted to be self-sustaining. That's clearly borne out by the 2004 judgment and decree. She anticipated that with an RN certification, she'd be able to sustain without any sort of payments from the respondent, albeit at a much lesser standard of living. But it was her feeling that's demonstrated in the record that her husband's reference to her as being lazy, as being on the gravy train, as not wanting to work, and so on and so forth, was all part of the respondent's position that my client wasn't entitled to anything, and she should be on her own. So in order to avoid future conflicts, because they did have a child in common, my client sought only what she would need once it was determined that the RN position was out of the picture for her going forward and in order to support herself to some modicum.
Mr. Olson, yes. You referenced the only logical explanation is the proverbial splitting, and wouldn't it be true under the case law that even assuming that's true, and we won't know that, of course, as long as the court has laid out findings that analyze the factors for the spousal maintenance, if that's what happens to be, that would still be sustained as long as all the factors are analyzed, even though your client might disagree, of course, with the ultimate finding and end result.
Well, we don't believe that the trial court appropriately weighed the standard of living element in particular.
Well, you didn't take issue with the findings by the court that responded in this case. I mean, he took on the lion's share of the debt. Could that not be a reason that the district court would have fashioned spousal maintenance in the way it did? I mean, taking on the debt goes against his income, and that's a burden he has.
Well, we addressed that in particular, actually in great detail, both at the trial court level and also on appeal. He didn't take on the lion's share of the debt. When it all came out in the wash, he arguably came out ahead in the debt situation.
Get the house, two mortgages, eventually sold the house, didn't net a significant amount, and then I thought he also took on the remaining deficits that the parties had in terms of marital debt repayment. I mean, correct me, because I tell me where in the record I will find evidence contrary to that.
I Your Honor, I'll look for that evidence while I'm...
I want you to take your time doing that. It's just, that's one of the findings that, when I reviewed the district court's findings of fact, that's the finding that I find, and a district court is so determining. I didn't see that there was any objection from you that in fact happened.
There was repeated objection to it, Your Honor. And again, I'll find it while counsel is arguing his points. In particular, I know we addressed it again in our reply brief where we referred to this argument that he took on all this debt as a canard, that it really didn't happen because the property turned out being worth $30,000 more than what the respondent represented it to be at the time of the divorce. So when he sold the property, he came out $9,000 ahead. Part of the big problem in this case is the failure on the respondent's part to produce any sort of current documentation or evidence of his income, any sort of current documentation of what his assets were other than what he claimed they were. And for instance, we were provided with a one-page document pertaining to real estate issues. That one-page document was the first page to the closing statement pertaining to the sale of the house. It didn't have the second page that explains where the costs and disbursements went, if there was, in fact, a second mortgage to be paid off, and so on and so forth. The record also demonstrates that the respondent was able to retire somewhere near $20,000 in debt after the divorce and was able to maintain monthly living expenses of approximately $7,300 a month. He admitted in both his answers to discovery and his testimony that he was making those payments, and that $7,300 included the $1,000 a month that was being paid to my client.
Isn't there evidence in the record, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that the respondent borrowed money from his father in order to sell the house, and that after the sale of the house, he still owed his father money?
It was actually his mother.
Okay, mother. Sister, brother.
He claimed that he borrowed money from his mother.
But she testified.
Yes,
mother
she did.
Testified, so yeah, we have a credibility determination, right?
Well, largely, but there is also no backup documentation supporting either of their assertions.
But the court found that testimony credible, didn't it?
Well, basically it did by making findings regarding it, yeah.
Yes.
It did.
So we defer to the district court's credibility determinations.
Right. But we don't even have to reach those particular issues here for my client to prevail on appeal, though. I'll point out some glaring errors by the trial court. One is, by according my client more than $2,000 less in monthly expenses than someone who's earning more than double what my client is earning, to me is per se error by the court. That is clearly not some sort of a fair determination of the maintenance award in this case. Furthermore, the trial court found that the respondent's monthly expenses were $4,900 a month. Those were the reasonable monthly expenses the trial court found. On the other hand, again, the respondent testified that he was paying $7,300 a month, every month, including the maintenance award of $1,000. He was also retiring close to $20,000 worth of debt during that same period of time. He was also paying for his girlfriend's expenses. He was also paying for an adult child's expenses. So if we take the $73 that he admits he was paying, add that on to the $4,900 that the court found was a reasonable amount, technically he's got another $2,400 a month by his own acknowledgement to pay in maintenance. Yet the trial court said, even with his ever-expanding income and earnings, which we don't know what they were because he didn't disclose anything beyond 2015, even with that expanding earnings and income, his expanding retirement benefits that far exceeded those of my clients, he now has somewhere around $4,500 discretionary income based on the trial court's determination that $4,900 was a reasonable number. That's over and above what my client has. The real issue, or I should say the real evidence of the argument about quote-unquote splitting the baby here, is if you actually examine the amount of reasonable expenses that the trial court allowed for each of the particular parties, and determinations by the trial court with regard to what the parties' net incomes were, the respondent ended up with a surplus each month of $111. My client had a $39 deficit, even though the court only accorded her $2,000 less in monthly expenses. So again, there's really no logic to that, to award the $500, other than it's right down the middle, because it ends up in an outcome that clearly isn't fair under the circumstances. I would also note there are some other issues we take with the trial court's findings and methodology in this matter. For instance, the trial court, without assigning any fault to the respondent for failing to provide any current income information, which we would argue was his burden to demonstrate that he didn't have the ability to pay maintenance or didn't have the ability to pay attorney's fees, even with that, the trial court averaged his income from 2012 through 2015 to come up with his net or his gross income number. The problem with that is the respondent conceded and testified his income was going up every year. So here we are in the middle of 2017, and the trial court is using an average between 2012 and 2015.
Well, you know, and I struggle with this on family cases all the time. The district court certainly could have made an adverse inference based on the testimony. But we don't second guess what the district court did absent clear error. And the district court heard the testimony and decided what it did based on the evidence before it. How do we get around that facet?
I think you get around it when you look at the overwhelming evidence to the contrary to what the district court's determination was. And again, everything weighs against this decision. It makes no sense. There's no explanation for why my client, after 22-plus years of marriage in a traditional role, ends up walking away, having to live in an apartment down on Nicollet Avenue, while the respondent, according to his own testimony, is doing better than at the time of the marriage or the time of the dissolution. There are a couple other issues I just wanted to emphasize briefly. We did take issues with the trial court's actual determinations of the monthly expenses my client had. In particular, this was a bare bones budget. Compare that to the respondent's budget that was $7,300. My client's was half the amount of the respondent's with half the resources available to her. Yet the trial court disregarded items arbitrarily from the expenses my client listed, in particular, disregarded the attorney fees that were claimed, $300 a month, which would take 10 years, according to the information in the record, to pay off the attorney's fees. Trial court did not give my client the benefit of those. Trial court gave my client the benefit of nothing for future housing, nothing for future car purchases or anything of that sort. On the other hand, the respondent purchased a new vehicle while this was going on at the very beginning of it in April of 2017. Getting to one other point I wanted to make was, and that is, the trial court professed to have used the tax tables in making determinations of net income, but it didn't explain how it did. There's nothing in the record indicating what numbers it took, what it applied, what deductions were actually used, or anything of the sort. And we would argue that without the current information from the respondent, that was improper, and the court should have used the method that we suggested, and that is taking the actual tax returns, albeit 2015 was stale for the respondent, and looking at the amount of taxes actually expended off of the gross to determine the actual monies available. And I see my time's up. Thank you.
5 minutes rebuttal, Mr. Olson. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Brian Flackney, and I represent the respondent, Joseph Sanders, who's seated behind me here today. This case arose in the district court on cross motions. We went to trial in front of the district court asking that the court stop maintenance altogether because under the original district court decree, it was only for 36 months. And we wanted the maintenance to stop at zero and to not extend. And of course, they requested lifetime spousal maintenance and suggested $1,000. The parties engaged in extensive discovery and conducted a testimonial hearing that was held wherein both the parties testified and several other witnesses testified as well. The record therefore includes all the motion submissions, all of the testimony and the trial testimony exhibits. So the record's rather extensive. Now the trial court, its decision extending maintenance at $500 a month and making it permanent, and the court did not allow the attorney's fees request that the appellant is now requesting. The appellant asked for amended findings. So the court issued its original decision and then the appellant brought a request for amended findings and the court addressed those amended findings and augmented the record and to show its calculations, and those are part of what the court has, part of what the appellant has appealed from is those amended findings in which Judge Werminger expanded and explained why it is that he had made his calculations and determinations. Now, I find myself in a somewhat difficult position today. I am arguing today to this court to uphold a decision that my client doesn't particularly like. And remember, he asked at the trial court that he have no spousal and maintenance and it terminated immediately. So I'm asking, please uphold a $500 a month permanent spousal and maintenance award. But while the appellant clearly doesn't like the decision of Judge Werminger, this appeal isn't about making people happy. The parties ceded control over their happiness when they gave the matter of these issues to the trial court. Now the trial court has made its decision. I believe the issue in front of you today boils down to basically two things. A, did the record support the decision? And B, did the trial court abuse its discretion? Another way of saying is, was the trial court clearly erroneous?
Mr. Flackney, since your client did also have a motion, of course, to vacate, basically reduce to zero, why did he not submit as part of his income information his 2016, 2017 tax returns?
He did provide some paycheck stubs that brought that more current, and he did testify on the record. So there is in the record his statement that his income was approximately $90,000, which was the same as it was in the last year for which he provided a tax return. So the court could make the determination based upon the record it had before it that the $90,000, give or take some change, was the appropriate number.
Wouldn't that be a natural best way to show that exact information to submit it? Was it never asked for in a pre-hearing discovery, for instance, or was it at least he cross-examined on that by appellant's counsel? Why didn't you submit those tax returns?
I don't disagree with you that it would have been a better method to have supplied the most recent tax return. I agree with you. It didn't happen, but it doesn't make the record defective. I mean, the court still had adequate information in front of it to determine that the $90,000, give or take some change, was the appropriate dollar amount. And the judge felt comfortable making that decision when he said, this is what I find to be his income. And then he buttressed it with the income averaging to come up with the same number. But he certainly had plenty of information in front of him to make the determination of what his income was. In retrospect, as we try these cases, trial court practitioners, I mean, that would have been a better practice. I agree with you. Well, in any event, both parties have identified in their briefs the standard review. I don't think there's much disagreement about that. It's an abuse of discretion standard, right? But I also cited the Vogness and Vogness case where the court is further instructed that when determining whether findings are clearly erroneous or not, The appellate court review should view the record in the light most favorable to the district court's findings. So I believe that there's a rather heavy burden that Mr. Olson and his client have to overcome to get the relief that they're requesting. Now, the respondent's brief identifies significant and substantial factors not identified in the appellate's brief. I mean, there was a very wide variety of facts put into the record. Both parties were represented by longtime trial counsel who are well familiar with what goes on in Dakota County, and there's a very robust record. I mean, I put in a record that supports, in my opinion, cutting the maintenance off. And Mr. Olson put in the record facts that support his position, and there was lots of facts that were in the record. I think that a trial court could have had a very broad array of decisions that it could have made based upon the record that it had. But the point is, the record supports the decision this judge made in this case. All right? Now, I believe that the well-developed record in this case may have supported any number of alternatives, but the fact remains that the district court made a decision, and this record does support it. Now, Mr. Olson didn't touch on it in his argument, but he does make a request about the attorney's fees, and I believe as to his attorney's fees request review, once again, the standard is abuse of discretion. The trial court, in its amended findings, specifically addressed the basis for that decision. He went back and looked at that question, and he made specific findings. I point out that this case is not a conduct-based attorney's fees request. It's a needs-based, and so under the Minnesota statutes, I believe 518.14 controls. So if you make an attorney's fees request in a family law case, you got to look at that, and there's a factor analysis, and you got to go through the factors, which this judge, trial court judge, did. Now, the appellant has cited in its brief State versus Paulson. I've argued in my brief that that reliance is misplaced. That decision was based upon a different statutory scheme and involved a state agency case. This is one of those condemnation cases where if you win the condemnation, there's a factor analysis that you go through to determine whether or not the attorney representing the condemned property is entitled to their fees. And you're entitled to your fees, you just have to prove out what they should be. And those factors are, you know, how complicated was the case, what was the skill and talent of the lawyers involved, you know, those types of factors. That's what Paulson talks about. When I went to the website of the Court of Appeals and I looked at the handy-dandy guide that you guys have got about the standard of review, the Paulson decision in the context of a family law attorney's fees review is not noted at all. The case that's noted is Gully versus Gully, and I believe that it's still the abuse of discretion standard, and I believe that the 518.14 standards are the ones that are at play. Now, you know that I don't get a chance under the briefing protocols to respond to the reply, but I just wanted to make a quick oral response to the reply. I've got a moment or two, I guess. Mr. Olson has made five statements in his reply brief where he says that there's something that's not in the record that I stated in my brief. He says it five times. And I want just to give you an example. In his reply brief, on page 3, he says on page 5 that Joe attempts to paint a dire picture regarding the parties allegedly living beyond their means and incurred debt so in furtherance of their marital standard of living. That attempt isn't supported by the evidence. That's what he says in his reply brief. Well, in my brief, what I said on page 5 was the parties lived a lifestyle that was beyond their means. And they used credit cards and other debt mechanisms to bolster their lifestyle that they could not afford. The appellant testified that sometimes the lifestyle she enjoyed during the time of the marriage was financed by the debt of the two of them. And then I cite document 73 at 79. So I cite the exact location. Well,
obvious from the list of debts in the judgment and decree?
It's absolutely the case. And so when he makes that statement in his reply brief, what I'm trying to point out to you is that he simply is wrong. And so because I don't have a chance to reply to every portion of it, I just want to give you one example. All right? Well, if I was Mr. Olson, I would be throwing every bit of flotsam and jetsam into the ocean to determine whether or not he could find something that floats. but I believe that his case is sinking as fast as the Titanic, and that's what should happen. Neither the appellant or the respondent are pleased with the trial court's decision, but the reality is that the record supports it. And while the decision is unpopular, it is not clearly erroneous. For all the reasons set forth in our brief, and as adequately demonstrated from review of the record, I believe that the court should affirm the order of Judge Werminger and deny this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Flackney. And Mr. Olson, you get the last word.
Your Honor, I'm not going to personally attack Mr. Flackney here. This involves representation of two clients, and the record is what the record is. I would note that I'm still having difficulty for some reason locating the exact location, but it is in both the brief and reply brief where it actually goes through what happened to those purported debts that were purportedly in existence at the time of the dissolution.
Certainly ferret out the record. We'll look
right
into that. Thank you.
And many times this has to be done in reverse as far as the comments that are made. But with regard to the attorney fee issue, I'm not clear what the argument is pertaining to the Paulson case. It's a seminal case with regard to attorney fee awards under Rule 119. Abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard for awards of attorney's fees. And one of the ways the trial court abuses the discretion is to either make factual findings that aren't supported by the record, or by applying the law in a manner inconsistent with the law. The law says that when looking at a request for attorney's fees, you can't disregard the expenses on the one hand that are listed as actual attorney's fees, and on the other hand, just simply decide not to award the fees. We've cited a number of cases in our brief regarding the standards that are implied here and are applied here, and they clearly involve a fairness issue, that where the trial court has actually divided income, assets, whatever the case may be, but in this case, income, because the asset distribution was done 4 years before the determinations were made, it has to be fair and equitable, or else trial court has to look at awarding attorney's fees. Contrary to counsel's representation, there was no current pay stub provided to the trial court. The most current pay stub was a December 2016 pay stub. So we had an additional 6-7 months of time that we have no idea what the respondent's income was.
But wasn't he a salaried employee? I mean, he earned approximately $80,000 when the parties were divorced. The court found that his current income as of 2015, using
right
that figure, was in excess of $90,000. And if you had a pay stub from 2016, you would have known whether that had substantially changed. And so even if he was earning $95,000, I mean, would that dramatically change the picture here?
Well, let's say it's $95,000 or $100,000, because he's got a history of earning bonuses. Remember that. So why didn't he provide this?
That's substantial bonuses. If his income only increased about $10,000 or $12,000 since the divorce.
Understood. But
your client's income increased by more than, I mean, she earned more than twice as much
at
the time of this hearing. You did a good job for her.
And the amount of money that she actually realized is insignificant compared to the respondent.
I understand that.
Okay.
I do.
I just lost my thought.
I'm sorry.
Here's the point. The court can't speculate as to what the income is, and that's what the trial court did here. It speculated because the information wasn't provided that was required to be provided by the respondent in this case. We don't know. Maybe he was making $120,000 at that point in time. And the fact is you can't look at prior performance because if the company's doing better or he's advancing, by his own testimony, he was going to college to finish his college degree, and perhaps his employer was giving him increases in pay because of that. But we don't know what his income was. That's the whole point, and it was his burden to demonstrate it. And again, we've got December information. My client, in the weeks before trial, provided all current information, all updated information. My office requested the same from Mr. Flackney's office. We got nothing. So what's missing here? What's hiding? The trial court should have been asking these questions. It didn't ask these questions. It didn't question it in its decision. The fact is it really said nothing about it, and we assign that as error in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for appearing today. The matters were well argued. We will take the subject matter under advisement, issue a decision. That does conclude our oral calendar today, so we are in adjournment. Thank you much.